Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Calfee Law Firm. And on today's show, we will be focusing on the impact of mentorship in compliance and how, as mentors and mentees, we can become the very best version of our compliance selves. To help guide us through the conversation, we are very pleased to welcome back to the show attorney and former regulator and insightful mentor, Mr. Richard Such. In our headline section, we look at the notable decline in SEC enforcement actions in 2025 and review the recently announced rulemaking agenda for the SEC in upcoming months. And finally, we'll wrap up today's show with another installment of Outtakes, where we see continued focus from the SEC enforcement on the marketing rule and accurate disclosure of conflicts of interest. Moving into our headline section, in an article on Investment News by Leo Almazora, the author notes the Securities and Exchange Commission has seen a marked decline in enforcement activity this year, with a new analysis suggesting the agency is prioritizing clear-cut investor fraud over more technical violations of its rules. A review by the law firm King & Spalding found the SEC initiated 67 enforcement actions from February through July, down from 127 in that same time period last year and 198 during that comparable stretch in 2021. That amounts to a 47% decrease from 2024 and a 66% drop from 2021. The law firm's report goes on to point out several potential causes for this, including a shift in regulatory priorities and a significant reduction in staff. The analysis comes as the SEC, now under the leadership of Paul Atkins, appears to be moving away from the aggressive enforcement style seen during Gary Gensler's tenure. Gensler, who led the agency during the Biden administration, was known for his assertive or aggressive approach, particularly in the crypto sector, where he consistently fought for broad regulation of digital assets. Atkins, who had previously co-chaired a crypto lobbying group, has signaled a more accommodative stance towards the industry. The drop in enforcement actions coincides with a roughly 15% reduction in the SEC's workforce, part of the broader government downsizing effort. A separate note recently published by the law firm Winston & Strawn observed that the SEC had 5,000 employees and 2,000 contractors by the end of the 2024 fiscal year, which declined to 4,200 employees and only 1,700 contractors as of May 6th of this year. Some observers have noted that the rush to finalize cases in the final months of the previous administration may have left fewer pending actions for the current leadership. King & Spalding reported that from October 1st, 2024, to January 19th, 2025, the SEC brought 173 enforcement actions, an unusually high number for such a short period. Securities offerings in cases involving registered investment advisors or investment companies accounted for most of the enforcement actions in the first half of the year, often involving alleged misappropriation of client funds. Broker-dealer cases, by contrast, dropped sharply, with only two actions being brought from February to July, compared with 18 in the same period the prior year. The report noted one major factor contributing to this decline is the absence of actions related to the use of off-channel business communications, something we've talked about on this show quite a bit over the past couple of years, and which was a key and sometimes controversial priority for the SEC during the last administration. Commissioners Mark Ueda and Hester Peirce, two of the three remaining commissioners currently at the agency, along with Caroline Crenshaw, have previously dissented against the agency's aggressive stance on off-channel communications, emphasizing the need for a more balanced approach. In a statement last year, they argued that the SEC's actions in this area, quote, raise serious questions about fairness and regulatory overreach, end quote. Compliance priorities among investment advisors have also shifted along with the change at the SEC leadership. The latest Investment News Compliance Testing Survey found that off-channel business communications are becoming less of a focus, though they remain an area of ongoing scrutiny. The impact of staff reductions and buyout programs at the SEC is still unfolding, leaving many in the industry to watch closely for signs of how enforcement trends may continue to develop in the coming months. The future direction of SEC enforcement remains uncertain, especially as the agency recently appointed a permanent enforcement director, a role that will likely help shape those priorities moving forward. Moving to our next headline, earlier this month, the SEC unveiled its rulemaking agenda for the upcoming months, which could see broad proposals to revamp cryptocurrency regulations and reduce rules Wall Street has decried over the years as being overly burdensome. The SEC formally outlined several of its initiatives to overhaul cryptocurrency policies, which SEC Chair Paul Atkins had previewed in July. Those include proposing rules about the offer and sale of digital assets, which the SEC said could potentially include certain exemptions and safe harbors, and clarifying how its broker-dealer rules apply to crypto. The SEC also said it would consider amending its rules to allow for crypto to be traded on national securities exchanges and alternative trading systems. If enacted, those policies would represent a major win for the digital asset industry, which has long pushed for tailored rules that would enable crypto to become more and messed with traditional finance. SEC Chair Atkins noted, quote, "This regulatory agenda reflects that it is a new day at the Securities and Exchange Commission. The items on the agenda represent the Commission's renewed focus on supporting innovation, capital formation, market efficiency, and investor protection," end quote. On the campaign trail last year, President Donald Trump courted crypto cash by pledging to be a, quote, crypto president and help promote the adoption of digital assets. This appears relatively in stark contrast to former Democratic President Joe Biden's regulators, who were often focusing to protect Americans from fraud and money laundering and tried to crack down on the industry, particularly in this area. The Biden administration's SEC sued exchanges Coinbase, Binance, and dozens more, alleging that they were often flouting U.S. federal securities laws. Trump's SEC has since dropped many of those cases. The SEC also plans to propose a plan for, quote, rationalization, end quote, of disclosures. The agency's core work includes laying out disclosure requirements meant to increase transparency and reduce risk for investors. The agency also flagged a plan to help reduce compliance burdens for public companies in connection with their shareholder proposals. Thank you to Hannah Long of Reuters for providing much of the content for that piece. As we move into the interview section of today's show, we're going to be talking about a subject that is near and dear to my heart and certainly involves a very compliance-related items, but also really transcends compliance specifically and ventures out more into the professional sphere. And we've done some shows like this in some of our prior episodes. You may remember folks like Rob Tall and some others that have come on to talk about the different unique mental health and mental challenges and things that people face when working in the role as a legal professional or securities compliance professional kind of in this space. But I am thrilled today to be bringing in, to welcome back to the show, in fact, Mr. Richard Such, who's going to be talking to us today about the value, the importance of mentorship, and how that has obviously influenced and impacted his own career as a legal professional and as someone heavily involved in the securities compliance space, and some of the lessons learned and other things that he can really share with us that I think are incredibly valuable for lots of folks listening to this podcast in their day-to-day lives and maybe with the teams and the other people that they get to work with. So, Rich, thank you so much for coming back on the show. Thrilled to have you here and looking forward to a great discussion.
Well, it's good to be back a second time. That's a sure sign that I didn't mess it up the first time around. Exactly. So thanks for your continued confidence in me.
It is well earned, my good man. It is well earned. And, you know, as we kick off the conversation, and you just heard me give a little bit of that intro there. But, you know, I would love to hear, obviously, I think some of the folks have gotten to know you from the last episode we did where we were really focused on senior investors and vulnerable investors and some of the different ways that we can help aid those folks and design compliance programs to help those folks. But you know, others listening now may not know some of your kind of history and how you got here. And so I guess a little bit, maybe just to kick things off, and feel free to kind of, we would love to hear your thoughts on how has mentorship and this notion of mentorship more broadly helped to shape your career, right? As a legal professional, as a securities compliance professional, as someone who's deeply involved in this space.
It's actually pretty easy. I could do like a real quick run through on what my positions have been, and every position I was in, I was able to find a good big brother or sister in the system that, you know, was a mentor, you know, while I was going through my days in that position. So when I clerked for a judge, the judge, Arnold Stein, was a very experienced guy who always got right to the point. And he was like my father in the law. I mean, my father is a lawyer, but I had he would have been my first or second phone call, the judge, when I was away from him. And part of it was because I knew he had my best interests at heart. And the other part was he just was so good at figuring out the fact pattern, say, do this, don't do that. After that, I kind of chose a traditional path in the law. I was a prosecutor. And there I had men and women that I still am in contact with to this day, had an interest in, you know, watching after me because I was, you know, the young prosecutor needed to learn. And, you know, when you are a young prosecutor, you get knocked around a lot. You win, you lose, you learn every day. And from there, I went into private practice. And we're going to be talking later about the three questions. I learned that from my patron saint at Lowenstein Sandler. His name was John Schuper, no longer with us. But he actually was kind of an indirect friend of the family. And so I had a connection with him just by virtue of that. But he was my patron saint at a very difficult place to navigate. And then, you know, as time went on, I guess you start to shift. You go from the mentored to the mentoring. So by the time I, you know, finished out at Bressler and was in regulation, and now I'm at Stevens and Lee, more often than not, I'm extending, you know, the help as opposed to seeking it. But that's not to say I still don't have, you know, a cadre of people, and they range in age, by the way, from, I would even say in their 20s to the, you know, to my age and older, I'm 63, who I ask about things when I want to hear a smart person tell me what they think about what I'm trying to figure out myself. So, you know, mentors can be any age, mentees can be any age. And so in each of my positions in the law, I have had a need to talk to people to help me reach a conclusion. Now, by the way, family's there, right?
Sure.
But
sure.
Sometimes you think, well, you know, family, they kind of know you almost too well. I need somebody with a narrower focus. But mentors are everywhere. Potential mentors are everywhere. That you have to be smart enough to find them. That's it.
You touched on a couple things there. One, obviously, thank you for those remarks. And I love the way that you framed a couple really key points there. One of them in particular that I would just underscore, because I certainly felt it in my own life. Totally agree on the family part. Of course, you having your family around and friends and family that have known you for a long time is always a great support system. And of course, you can go to those people. But sometimes it's hard because one of the things that's interesting, I'll say on that, is that, you know, when you seek out other people, like whether it's a judge that you're clerking for, whether it's a chief compliance officer and you're a junior compliance person on the team, whatever your situation is, what's great is that that person is also often in the same industry as you. Now we'll probably talk about it at some point, and I would certainly be interested in your thoughts on, sometimes it's not always the direct report that you want to have as a mentor or sponsor or someone in your life. Sometimes it's having someone that can be a little bit adjacent. But I totally love the other point that you made about it doesn't always have to be, people hear the terms, I'm a mentor and I have mentees, or I'm part of a mentorship program, and they think it's always kind of trickling down from a much more senior person that's going down to a much more junior person. And of course, in general, someone who is more seasoned, who has more years of experience, is going to be able to share those experiences with a younger person. And that's often how it works. But what I loved about your comment is that you just actively seek out other really smart people at various levels of their career to dive in and have those kinds of relationships. Because I know personally some people that I maybe initially thought were like a peer of mine that I wouldn't necessarily have put in a mentor kind of a position early on turned out to be some of my best mentors because I was able to establish a rapport with them. They were only a couple years older than me, but ultimately the way that we were able to interact was because I wanted I valued the opinion of this other really smart person. And so I really wanted to hear their feedback on challenges and issues and other things that I was dealing with. And I would say that same calculus also applies, even if I'm going to somebody now, which is crazy to say, because it reflects on, you know, the fact that, you know, you mentioned your age a moment ago. You know, I'm well into my 40s and thinking about people that are 20 years my younger, right? But wanting to get their opinion still on stuff in a way that you have that same type of similar relationship.
Yeah. Like at the prosecutor's office, I remember John O'Reilly saying to me once, Richard, you do not need to be smart enough to know the answer to every question, but you do need to be smart enough to know when to ask a question. And I think the same goes true with navigating with the people you work with. You mentioned maybe not a direct report, but you don't need a direct report because what you're talking about within the organization is having a pal you trust that gets the context of the conundrum you're dealing with. And when you put together the knowledge, the willingness, and the context, you're much more likely to get good advice.
Could not agree more. Could not agree more. And I think one of the things that kind of indirectly is coming up in some of what yours and my conversation has led to thus far is really talking about, and one of the questions I guess I have for you, talk to me about some of the benefits specifically that you've received. First, obviously, you mentioned some of the relationships you had early in your career. You've talked about now continuing to identify and seek out those types of relationships now more on the senior side of that. But I would love to hear your thoughts on, you know, when you're trying to establish this kind of relationship or this kind of a rapport, what are some of the benefits for the mentor and what are some of the benefits for the mentee?
On the mentor, point to the prayer of St. Francis. You know, it's better to give, really. And in the giving, one receives. I really believe that. And if you don't really believe that, maybe this is not the exact right thing for you to be endeavoring to do. And it isn't for everybody. You know,
of course,
people have their own things they're managed. They're better with sharing thoughts and emotions. Some are better than others, obviously. But for the person that seeks the advice, I say to my kids, try not to do things that are going to compromise your ability to do whatever, choose the option you might want to do in the future. Avoid like mistakes that you'll really come to regret. And that's the kind of thing I think if you find the right mentor and you've got a choice, like, you know, should I take this assignment with this person who really is not the easiest person to work with? Or should I, you know, list the things that I'm doing and really make it sound like I'm busy? You know, and then if I'm the mentor in that question, I'm thinking, well, are you too busy to satisfy somebody who is demanding? If you are, don't set yourself up for failure. But the mere fact that the person is difficult doesn't mean you can't win them over. And it is a competitive business and it's, you know, not for the faint of heart. So, you know, why not try? I mean, I would always rush into those fires. You know, I was, you know, maybe too young or too stupid to be scared, you know, when I ran in and volunteered for some of the things I did. But if it were like something that were like a career influencing or like, will I make partner influencing or am I going to get this position influencing? It, you know, much like you would count on your mom or your dad when you're a kid, you know, mom and dad may not get the question or they may be help, as we pointed out. But the context and the relationship with somebody who is to be trusted can make all the difference in the world in avoiding problems, therefore just enhancing your career arc.
Yeah, totally agree with that. And sometimes persons that can be, have a tag of being difficult to work with, or, you know, don't have a good reputation of, like, you know, to use another analogy, being a really easy professor, right? They're a more challenging type. So sometimes
look, I've been told I'm difficult to work with. I don't, of course, understand that, because how could that possibly be so? But, you know, you I mean, the demand. You know, when you're in litigation, when you're in a trial, I in essence become a different person. Now I'm relying on the fact that I'm not that person all the time, so that I've got goodwill built up with these people, and they'll get it. But I think the mere fact that people are demanding is not a bad thing, because let's face it, demanding people make it to the higher levels. And that's where we all want to be. We want to play the A game.
Yeah.
Until we don't. And then we, you know, we stop playing it.
Totally get it. And so I love that item you mentioned there about kind of, again, like, you know, having those people that, again, may be a tougher grader, so to speak, but then, again, not necessarily giving yourself short shrift there, because, again, that could be an excellent person to learn and grow from, because they're going to be a person that's going to challenge you. If no one challenges you to do things differently or to do things better, are you ever really going to be able to reach your maximum potential? I would certainly think you're always going to be leaving a little bit something short there. The other thing that I'll add to that is, and this would be obviously a benefit for the mentee, you know, ultimately, but I know I've heard other people tell me in the past. So for any of those more junior compliance professionals or legal practitioners that are out there listening to the show right now, I've gotten feedback from folks that I work with, as well as from others, that they are scared, or they don't want to bother somebody else to ask them to serve in that role for them, or to get more involved with them. Or they just said, you know, look, there's no way that so-and-so, you know, here at Calfee, with a law firm that I work at, that they would ever want to take me on as a mentee. And I said, you're not going to lose anything if you ask. And ultimately, more often than not, I've found in situations like that, I mean, you know, a lot of people just want to be in a position to help. And there are people, like you said earlier, that get a lot out of giving back. So why not just ask the question? If the person's too busy and they can't do it, I'm sure they'll let you know. But then you're just left in the same position you were when you started.
So I think perhaps that question or issue, as you described it, is framed a little bit too formally, and let me suggest an alternate path for anybody that asks you that question in the future.
Yeah.
Don't go and ask somebody, will you be my mentor? Don't ask them that. I mean, because that's like,
fair.
You know, so instead, and I don't think people like anything more than having you ask their opinion about something, because it, you know, in the asking of the question, it implies that you value what they will say, unless, of course, you're so obsequious you're asking the question just to flatter the person, which is not the purpose of our discussion here today. But to me, it happens because both of you are buying what the other is selling. Like, you get along. You know, if you talk about the game last night, you hear that person is focused on the right plays. If they're talking about their kids, they're talking about their kids in a way that is consistent with how you think people should talk about kids. So, you know, you're not really going into this blind. You're just trying to identify people who have values and intelligence that you think will give you a meaningful insight on something that you think that they would have no problem at all helping you with. You know, you're not asking them for 10 grand. You're asking them, what do you think about this? I'm perplexed. I see that you could choose A or B. What do you think? I'm curious to know. And I think people love to tell you what they think.
Totally agree. And down the line, and by the way, your comment is making me smile and laugh a little bit, because I can definitely see how the way that I said that question earlier came off like you were asking somebody to marry you, right? Which which is definitely not the idea here. But what I love is that, even though I wasn't trying to do that, but I love that you clarified it, because it is
such an important point, which is that like you're simply looking for other people that like you talked about, like a value set and perspective on the way that you're doing things, and then also likely because of where you're bumping into this person are probably involved in a similar space or a similar profession of some type where it makes sense for you to, again, be able to expand the types of people that you deal with at that workplace, inside that job, inside that company, in your community, wherever it is that you're bumping into that person. And you're right. It's not, it doesn't have to be this kind of formal courtship.
Yeah. And I want it to be exclusive. I'm a monogamous mentee, just so you know. I'm not going to seek other advice.
Right. No, right. Don't make it weird. Right. Yep. As I like to say to my kids all the time.
And it's good you did phrase it that way, because really the point is that there, I wouldn't say I have the official title. Nobody's really ever asked me. Usually when I see someone I think I can help and I like what they are, I'll mm-hmm. offer them the help before they even ask. Sure. Because I believe in, you know, you can see it could be anybody from like an outstanding waiter at a restaurant that mm-hmm. he hears and, you know, thinking about law or finance to, you know, people in law school or in compliance roles. It's finding matches that you know will work that are built on trust.
Yeah. So as we've kind of dug in a little bit now into the subject about kind of what are some of the things that you can do as you maybe look to establish some of these kinds of relationships, right? What's been some of the overall kind of how has it helped to guide and shape your career? The importance of it being, you know, what are some of the benefits for the mentor? What are some of the benefits from the mentee side? Now, I want to dig in a little bit and I'm going to get, you know, we're going to get personal here, Rich. So we're going to get personal.
Thanks for the warning.
but talk to me about some of the lessons that you received. I mean, kind of as a mentee earlier on in your career, some of the lessons that you've experienced or learned, right, as a mentor that continue to bring you back and inspire you to keep kind of engaging in these kinds of relationships and doing this type of activity. I'd love to hear a little bit about that. And then we can talk about even some other additional guidance, you know, for folks that are looking to continue to elevate their own careers.
You know, there's all kinds of vignettes that if I had really thought about and written them down, I could have them readily at hand. But, you know, just going back through some of the people that I described, I told you what John O'Reilly said about being smart enough to ask the right question. And by the way, that's a statement, and it's a simple statement. But if you think about what it means, what it means is I want you to have good judgment. And like in the law in particular, that is the product. There is the law, there are the facts, and then there's the application of judgment to what those facts mean in the legal construct. Same exact thing in compliance. There are the regs, there is the activity, you know, going on, there's maybe not a bright line answer, and that's when, you know, having help from older folks or people more experienced than you is really what you're looking for, or at least as experienced as you.
Sure.
But like the judge, for example, and this has stuck with me. I mean, it's 40 years now. He said to me, because there were a variety of cases we dealt with in the appellate division in New Jersey, and that's where we were. It was the last right of appeal in New Jersey. So trial court, appellate, and then Supreme, they didn't take every case. So this was the last resort court, and you saw everything. And some of the cases were big and some were small. And I'm not talking about money. I'm talking about like the breadth of the issues, the complexity of the case. And, you know, to someone like me coming in, all I knew is that we had 10 opinions to clear a month. Right. And the judge said to me when I was talking about the number of cases and the work, he said, Richard, you can't treat every case like every case. And, you know, a very simple statement. But what does it mean? You know, as important as this appeal is to someone, that does not mean it actually is that important in the whole scheme of things, as a matter of justice, as a matter of our docket, et cetera. I mean, and so definitionally on a case that is not that important, you just can't spend the same amount of time on that case as the most important case on the docket. Why? you will be wasting time on that case that really doesn't matter that much, and not spending the time necessary on the most important case on the docket. So don't treat every case like every case. Has application, by the way, to every single thing one runs into in their life. It's like you got to know when it's like hair on fire and when it is a yawn. If you can't tell the difference between those two things and treat everything like it's hair on fire, you're going to have an anxiety level that is not appropriate.
Totally agree. Now let me even do another bridge directly into compliance. Because one thing we talk about on this podcast all the time is in compliance, especially, you don't have never-ending resources. And in fact, oftentimes you're playing from maybe not behind the eight ball, but you're certainly not the first place people are going to go inside of a company or inside of a business or other places to give you an advance of resources where, you know, it's over the top. And so being in a position then to run a risk-based compliance program or to be able to apply that kind of filter to the stuff that you have to deal with inside your compliance program to help run it effectively, what an important skill. Not every issue that comes to you that you identify in your compliance program is something that you're going to need to spend hours and hours or days or weeks or months or years on. Some things are going to be, of course, are going to take a much higher priority. And so being able to have that governor, right, to be able to make the right call on the things that you should be applying those resources to, what an important lesson learned and skill to apply to your professional life.
Well, and the law, there's a direct correlation in that notion in billable rates, because it comprehends the fact that it's not going to take Patrick at age 40-something as long as it did to take Patrick at age 20-something to get something done.
We can hope.
But understanding the wheat from the chaff is another way of putting it. It's very important, because lawyers in particular, I think, have a real difficulty eliminating issues and noise from the machine and really only focusing in on what needs to be focused on. And you know, like in trials, I always used to say the documentary evidence comes down to like 8 or 10 documents. I don't care if there's, you know, 5 million documents exchanged in discovery. There's always 5 or 8 documents that everybody knows the exhibit number of by the end of the hearing that move the dial.
Yeah. Well, they have a word for it, right? Like, you want to avoid the dicta stuff that you have in the legal terms where, you know, people used to grab, you know, from a decision, they'd grab this language and they'd say, oh, this is dispositive that I need to put forward in another case. It's like, no, that wasn't actually the law that came out of that. That's the stuff on the periphery. That's just the dicta stuff that doesn't really matter. So, you know, but one other item that I wanted to touch on with you, because I do think, you know, full disclosure, I've talked to Rich. You've, you know, given me sage advice in the past time to time on related items in my own professional career. But one of the things that we've
talked about. Look where you are talking to me. I mean, the sky's the limit.
One of the things that you've talked about before that I really enjoyed getting to hear you speak on, and that I would love for our audience to get to hear from you, because I think it's helpful for folks that are in this space, right? So I'm talking about those legal practitioners kind of in the investment management or related practice areas of law, and those, you know, securities compliance professionals and those folks that are helping to run these compliance programs. But you've talked about kind of 3 questions that folks can be asking themselves as they're really getting involved in their career and identifying, is this something that I can see myself doing long-term? Is this something that I'm really enjoying? And also, am I in the right fit right now where I'm at, right, based on their current role or current firm or other things? And so I would love for you to share what are some of those key questions that you can be asking yourself, and maybe, you know, help flesh those out a little bit for the benefit of our listeners.
Okay. Again, I'm going to credit John Schuper here. There are 3 things that I talk to people the most about when I talk to people about either. And by the way, this applies to me seeking help and me giving help. First is like kind of launching your career. So that's usually high school, college, law school, and then young professionals. that, you know, how do you develop the first part of your career? And then I've talked a lot with people about the other side of it. What are you going to do for your, you know, soft landing? How's it going to look? When is the right time? Even money issues around, you know, do you have the number, right? And that number is different for everybody based on their spending. But the thing I think I talk about the most is I'm not sure whether or not where I am right now, my current job, is the right job for me. And I think there's availability in the market. I'm not certain, but I just wanted to talk to you about, you know, that. And so the three questions I say to people are, if they want to get the answer, and this is fail-safe, are, number one, are you happy? And I think the happiness part should be weighted a little more, because you're just going to function better if you're happy and not miserable.
Sure.
Number two, are you learning? And that can take a number of different, you know, forms. Are you learning just at the job? Are they paying you to go to school? Are they paying for your education? Are you getting advanced degrees? Are you part of organizations that you learn from? And then number three is, are you being reasonably compensated? And, you know, for example, when I was at the state, and I think you and I may have talked about this, I kind of had three yeses. And by the way, the end of the movie is you have to have two out of three yeses. If you don't have two out of three yeses, you should move. So, and particularly if you're not happy and you're not learning, compensation's not going to offset those two being no's.
Right.
If necessity is the mother of invention, okay, you have to make the money. I get it. But two out of three no's means you leave. It's hard to get three out of three yeses. But like when I was at the state, was I happy? I was like ecstatic. It was such a fun job. Was I learning? Of course. I mean, it was a whole new kettle of fish, even though I was involved with regulation. I made a whole new friend group that I really enjoyed and learned from. And then on the comp, I mean, I was making $86,000 as a New Jersey State employee. But that was what I kind of signed up for. So And at that point in my career, it really didn't matter that much. You know, I mean, I'm not sure I would have wanted to take that job when I was, you know, looking at 20 years of tuition, mortgage payments, sure, all the rest of it. So those are the three questions. And the happy one is usually pretty easy to answer if people are honest with themselves. Most people I talk to that are looking are reasonably happy, and the less happy they sound, the more alert I become toward weighting that factor. And then learning, you either are or you aren't, and you can tell that too. Mm-hmm. And then the comp, everybody knows with the market now, it's pretty transparent with the different, you know, apps that are out there in the law, and I'm sure in compliance. And some of that is situational too. I mean, if you're married, are you the sole earner? Do you have two people earning? Do you have kids? Do you not have kids?
Sure.
You know, what are your ambitions? You can make sacrifices on comp, but, you know, you are in it for a 30 to 40 year interval to save enough money as well as be able to spend the money needed to make the machine run.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the way that you frame that. It's obviously going to be at different points in your life, you're going to have to be pulling on the levers for those three questions in different ways. Right. And certainly that's important. But I do think it is interesting, and I'm glad that you framed it in the way that you did, in the way that the three questions kind of work together, because there are going to be times, and I can certainly tell you in different times in my life, where I wasn't always particularly happy with the exact role that I had. But man, I was learning a ton, right? And so I was overweighting how much I was learning, because I knew ultimately it was going to help me to do, you know, these other things that I wanted to do long term, right? And
same is true for me. There were years where I was arguably miserable, but I knew I was doing what I had to do, and that it was hard. Kind of back to the point of, do you work for the demanding person?
Yeah.
You know, Division One is there's a lot of practice in Division One sports for a reason.
Right.
And it's not easy. You know, three a days, it's not easy. So
yeah. Yeah.
You got to work. It's and it can make you miserable. But if you can see a way that the work And, you know, there's the whole thing of hard work being its own reward, and it can be. But again, you can't be miserable, like to the point of depression.
Correct.
Hard work is a necessary element, law or compliance, or law and compliance.
Yeah, yeah. No, I completely can appreciate that. And, you know, as we've talked about in other shows where, you know, you want to certainly avoid, you know, burnout or depression to a point where it becomes, you know, unproductive and in fact, potentially destructive. Right. But then there are going to be other instances where, again, because you're able to pay the bills, and because you're learning so much and you're ultimately going to be able to put yourself in a better position to achieve your ultimate goals, that's going to help set you up for the long term in a really beneficial way.
Sometimes you have to work harder than you think you should have to work in order to get where you need to go.
Right, right. One thing that's interesting about, and we've touched on this dynamic a little bit in our conversation today, but I'd love to get your thoughts on it directly, which is, you know, how can mentorship, or, and again, maybe where it's not necessarily the formal marriage, betrothal, or whatever situation I was describing earlier, but like, how can that concept, how can that idea of establishing these types of relationship, you know, impact overall productivity, right? Whether that's kind of certainly between people that might be working at the same organization, but I'll even go another layer down and say, like, within a team, like a compliance team, because I think there are a lot of people that also listen to this podcast that have a compliance department, right, inside of their own firms. And so, you know, maybe they've thought about having, I'm sure maybe they have some one-on-one type meetings with those folks right now, but you know, maybe they don't, or maybe they're looking to try to really establish a stronger rapport or relationship with some of those people on their team. How does mentorship impact the overall productivity among your employees?
Well, what I was thinking as you were asking about productivity is the word glue, you know, the stuff that keeps firms, teams, law firms together, particularly when the circumstances are extreme. So, you know, And it goes back to the point I was making about, are you happy? People, I think, generally will do better if they are overall happy as opposed to miserable. Just like in any relationship where you know one another well enough where you can, you know what the person would think about, you know, something, or you know, they finish your sentences, as you sometimes hear people say. When people know one another better, it has to inure to the efficiency of the operations. If for no other reason, there's going to be less bullshit through misunderstanding, right? Because people will just know better. What did that person mean by that?
Right.
Instead of not trusting, perhaps, what did that person mean by that? Which is a very corrosive thing, particularly for younger people. I mean, let's face it. If they are concerned about asking for guidance about things, something that I think is a relatively small ask.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine what it's like for them to wonder about, and then they would probably only be talking to family. When they've got this boss who said something at work today, they just don't know how to take it.
Right.
Right. So I think the secret to success in any good relationship is communication and obviously trust. So by working together in different situations, including just handling and trusting one another with issues that might even, for example, what if you made a mistake and you don't know what to do? You know, hiding your head in the sand is not, you know, going to make it better. But if you trust people you work with, that they're not going to try to find a way to make it worse, not make it better, which is obviously what you're hoping to do, you may not get a report on that. And that mistake might get hidden. And then what do you have?
Right. No, I agree 1,000% there. And let me add a couple thoughts to it and get your reaction to it, because I know, like, even here, you know, I talk to folks on our team all the time about, and one of the reasons that I will try to set up often a one-on-one with them separately, just to be able to dive into stuff just like this, is that ultimately we as human beings learn so much from the mistakes that we make. And we tend to, that doesn't mean that you can't learn from success, but success is not as good of a teacher often as mistakes are, right? And so when, what I tell people is don't be afraid to make mistakes, right? Because we're moving fast, and I would much rather have somebody that is going to be able to move the ball down the field, that's going to be able to move stuff forward and do so in a way that's thoughtful and considerate, and that they took time to figure out. But if ultimately it leads to a mistake, that's okay, because then we'll just get better from it, right? And that's what having that kind of a rapport, having that ability, so that, you know, I don't think it's productive sometimes to air out dirty laundry in front of an entire team when someone has made a mistake, right? But rather, then you can have a one-on-one with that person. You can give them the back and put them in a position where you say, hey, really good job on, you know, XYZ parts of that thing. Here are a couple areas where I think we can continue to help refine and enhance some of the language that we want to use there. And you do that in a way. And so now they feel validated. They feel like you've been able to give them really good feedback. They're going to be able to learn from that. But you didn't, like, you know, throw them under the bus, right? And yep. You have that kind of rapport with them.
Yeah. If you throw somebody on the bus, it's a good bet they're not going to ask you to be mentor for life.
They're not going to ask for that kind of monogamous relationship. No, I don't think they're going to do that. Well, as we look to wrap up today's show, Rich, one maybe a final thought and then a parting question for you. For those that are considering taking on a role as a mentor or a mentee, what additional advice or kind of words of encouragement would you give that, you know, person or individual?
I would say actively seek it out. And if you're the kind of person that's get satisfaction out of, you know, please and thank you. I mean, my mother used to say there's very little I won't do if you say please and thank you. And I think it has application to everybody you meet, really. There's something to, I suppose, teach and certainly learn from anybody there is. And it's hard to know the impact you will have on somebody if you make the commitment. And it does not need to be an enormous commitment. It could be 5 minutes, it could be a half hour, it could be a lunch. Yeah. You know, lunches are a good thing to do. I'm a big fan of lunch. But I'm back at St. Francis. It's in the giving that one receives. And I like nothing more than, you know, to hear that somebody that I talked to, you know, 5 years ago said that really helped me at a time when I didn't know what to do. And I, thankfully, I get plenty of comments like that. And in all the things I've done in my career, getting that kind of affirmation is about as rewarding as a trial win.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and if I can brag on the National Society of Compliance Professionals briefly, too, one of the things that I have appreciated most about of being involved with that organization over a period of time is the community. You know, legal and securities compliance professionals that it brings together, where you can have those kinds of meaningful conversations and relationships come about. In fact, I could make the argument that that's part of the reason that you and I are getting to connect right now, right? And so when you have access to that type of community, when you have access to those types of individuals, maximize it, right, to the best that you can.
Well, I'm coming up, I think it's about 30 years that I'm associated with NSCP, and it is my favorite trade group, and you know that, I've said this. And I believe in the mission, I believe in the community, I believe in the culture. You know, the idea that the whole group is in compliance for compliance, I never get that completely right, that, you know what I'm talking about, yeah, the catchphrase. Yeah. But it is about compliance for compliance, and it's not about positioning, and it's not about class system or any of that. It's, you know, I say to people, it's kind of like the blue collar compliance trade group. And it gave me my speaking start. They were the first organization that I got a slot to speak about broker dealer compliance issues. And I assure you, I was petrified going into that. And, you know, from time to time, I've gotten busy with my work and I've been more and less involved with NSCP. But, you know, it's not that it was a lack of love when I wasn't around. And now I'm at a point, as you know, where I can absolutely spend more time. So if there are people out there that have questions about this and want to talk to me, just reach out for me. Google me. You'll find me. I'm happy to discuss this with you directly. And if you need help, you know what? I have a reasonable amount of time. All good causes are welcome.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And yeah, for compliance by compliance is a tagline that the NSCP has used, you know, over the course of time. And it is really a good one because it is emblematic of how the organization operates. And it is so important when you can find that community of like-minded individuals, right, with similar interests and who have an ability to directly relate to the struggles and the challenges and the other stuff that you're feeling, because there's probably a pretty good chance that they felt them in some capacity on their own as well. Rich, it has been an absolute pleasure. And thank you so much for coming on the show. Again, so appreciate the opportunity of having to obviously gotten to know you well over the last few years, and for twisting your arm today to come on the podcast. But I wouldn't be doing my job if I let all those good deeds go unpunished. So I'm going to actually ask you one final question. You know, we're coming up here on the fall season, nearing the end of summer. What is your favorite fall activity to do?
I'm going to have to say football and bourbon.
That's a good one. That's a good fall activity. Maybe not as kid friendly as I have to focus my activities on these days.
Jumping a pile of leaves. Then.
That's a good one too. Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I'm hoping I can engage in both of those activities at some point over the fall.
There's a time for everything. You just have to make the time, and I know you're a busy guy. Patrick, thanks back. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thank you, Rich. And looking forward to having you back on the podcast here at some point down the road.
All right. Take care.
Thanks. The final part of today's show features another segment of Outtakes. As a quick reminder for some of our new listeners, if compliance were a TV show, think of this as the bloopers reel, where we look at entertaining, sometimes humorous, and often unsettling activities carried out of financial services firms that hopefully provide us all with a roadmap of what not to do when facing a similar situation or trying to avoid a similar compliance breakdown inside our respective firms. Essentially, leave these activities on the cutting room floor and outside your compliance program. Earlier this month, the SEC announced charges against a registered investment advisor for failing to comply with various provisions of the Advisors Act, especially in the areas of marketing, record keeping, policies and procedures, and the firm's annual compliance review. According to the SEC's order, the investment advisor disseminated a website advertisement in which it claimed it, quote, refused all conflicts of interest. However, even the firm itself recognized various conflicts of interest inherent in the role as an investment advisor, including those conflicts of interest that were previously disclosed in its Form 80-V Part 2A brochure. As such, the SEC's order found that the firm violated the requirement that the advisor have a reasonable basis to believe that it would be able to substantiate the claim in its advertisement that it, quote, refused all conflicts of interest upon demand by the commission. The SEC's order also went on to state that the advisor failed to maintain copies of all of its advertisements, including those that had appeared on its website for the periods required. The firm consented to the SEC's order and ultimately was asked to pay a fine of $75,000 as a civil penalty, and was also ordered to engage in undertakings designed to correct the compliance failures identified. Certainly at this point, we are nearly 3 years into the compliance date for the SEC marketing rule. And as though it weren't already abundantly clear, including from several of the risk alerts that have been published by the Division of Exams over the past several years, firms have to be in compliance with all parts of the SEC's marketing rule. And in particular, firms would do well to make sure that any
material statement of fact or claim that is made in any piece of marketing or on the firm's website or on any related social media pages, that the firm has the requisite documentation to be able to substantiate that particular statement of fact. And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Calfee and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guest, Richard Such, for coming on the show today and sharing his invaluable insights on the positive impact of mentorship in compliance and how we can all become the best version of our compliance selves. Please join us again next time on Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance in Context Podcast, or on X using the handle @ compliancepod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to complianceincontextpodcast.com to listen and learn more.